Okay, fun seekers, we're ready to get started on stocks. Sexy stocks, exciting stocks, risky stocks. Ooh. And what I have done here with the first presentation is cobble together some of the two of the chapters and some lecture notes that I have put together. Chapter 5 is the beginning of the stock market discussions in our textbook, and it spends too much time, in my humble opinion, on initial public offerings, as I will discuss in a few slides. They also spend too much time in Chapter 2 on buying and selling securities. And so in our presentation, we'll discuss a little bit about transactions. But again, they go into too much detail, so make sure you understand what's in the presentation. And then there are things that I think are important for you to know, and much of them you would have to know if you ever took the Series 7 to become a stockbroker. So this is our introduction to stocks. And we start with a quote from a humorist from the early part of the 20th century, Will Rogers. He's the person who said, there are no strangers, they're just friends I haven't met yet. He had a few gems that were still stand the test of time. For example, I don't belong to any organized political party. I'm a Democrat. Not much has changed in 80 years, has it? And what does Will Rogers, what did he have to say about stocks? Don't gamble. Take all your savings and buy some good stock and hold it till it goes up. And if it don't go up, don't buy it. Great advice, Mr. Rogers. Great advice. And were they stocks very much in the culture at the time, very much in the awareness of the culture? Oh, yes, because the first time in history, the common man got involved. Before that, stocks were just for gentlemen and the privileged. And now people were investing, and boy, did they get... Well, we'll see as we continue. Slide number 2. What are stocks? Well, stocks represent ownerships in a corporation. In fact, we use the term equities, equity financing, equity meaning ownership. And where did the term common stocks come from? Well, it has nothing to do with the fact that they're just common, everyday, ordinary, not that common. It comes from the original definition back in the 1600s or so of shareholders in common. Every share has one piece of the pie, and every share gets one vote when there's an issue that needs to be discussed and debated and voted upon. And everybody gets, if there's dividends, everybody gets a single piece of the dividends divided amongst equally amongst the shareholders. Now, some shareholders own a whole lot more stock than other shareholders, yeah. Why? Well, they enable investors to participate in the profits and growth generated by the business enterprise. Businesses are in business to earn money. We want to share in that growth. But one thing we don't discuss often is that stockholders are limited liability owners. They can only lose their investment. Now, after you buy a shares worth $100 or whatever they're worth, you could only lose your $100. They can't come after you later on, even if the corporation has many more debts. They can't come after the shareholders and say you have to pony up more money. Now that's different from a partnership or a sole proprietor. And if you take Business 120 at Southwestern or an introduction to business class anywhere, you would learn about the different legal structures of businesses. If you own a pizza shop or a shoe shop or any type of business and you haven't incorporated or done any other type of legal maneuver, legal establishment, automatically you are a sole proprietor unless you're working with another person who's not your spouse, in which case you're a partnership. And both sole proprietorships and partnerships are essentially, you know, one and the same with the individuals for whom who are the owners. So if the business incurs debt, the individual can be they can come after your house. Not so with shares, not so with common stocks, and people don't tend to concentrate on that. Has that ability been abused by certain individuals in the past? Oh, yes. Some people have set up sham corporations to try to shield themselves. And depending on the situation, there are certain instances where the authorities can pierce the corporate veil. You might have heard that term, piercing the corporate veil, meaning that this corporation was set up with the sole purpose of trying to hide somebody's assets from creditors and debtors. So, it's not foolproof. Now, what do stockholders receive? Well, dividends, optional payments of earnings, which we don't tend to concentrate on. Some investors do, and as you learn more and more about stocks, I hope you'll be one of them, because dividends are very cool. And the item that we tend to concentrate on when we think about stocks is capital gains, capital appreciation. The value of the corporation rises as the business grows, and almost invariably, not always, but almost invariably, the stock price will rise with it. Contrary to what many people believe and how many people behave, stocks are not simply millions upon millions of worthless pieces of paper that people trade every day for no reason. Well, now they don't even use paper anymore. It's all electronic, right? No, they represent ownership in real businesses. You own some shares of FedEx? Yes. When that FedEx or UPS and that truck drives by, you are a part owner of that. Now, if you own one share, maybe the lug nut on the left front wheel is yours, but still, you are part owner in that company. Slide number three. What has been the historical performance of stocks over the long term of modern finance? And why do we use the term modern finance? Well, there are historical reasons, but 1910s, 1920s, there are reasons that we could get into, but we won't, having to do with technology. The return from the stock market as measured by the Standard & Poor's 500 has averaged around 10-11% annually for the last 80-some-odd years. But in any one year, it is unlikely that the return will be 10% or 11%. No. That happens, but it's very unusual. The return has varied from a high of 53.8%. That was 1950s somewhere, to a low of minus 43.4, depression, and 2008 return was one of the worst, negative 38.5 after the housing bubble of the 2000s. And in any given year, there has been about a 1 in 3 or 1 in 4 chance of a down market. So it's not predictable. You can't say, okay, we've been up 3 years in a row, so that means the next year will be down. Or no, it doesn't work that way. The major exception during modern finance was the great run-up from 1982 to the year 2000, when the stock market went in two directions, up and way up. And everybody, well, yeah, but 2000 to 2002 was bad. Okay, anyway, let's continue. And let's take a look at the slide that we looked at back in Chapter 1 that shows the relative performance. And again, I want you to ignore small company stocks. Ignore small company stocks. It shows large company stocks, the S&P 500, the 500 largest companies in the United States, versus bonds, versus treasury bills and inflation. And we find that stocks have trounced the other choices, bonds and short-term investments as measured by the treasury bills. And inflation has been an issue. But what I want you to do is key on the left-hand side of this slide, the scale. This is this type of scale we often use when we look at exponential growth, because look, it goes from 0 to 1, and then it doesn't go to 2, it goes to 10, and then 100 and 1,000. See, every increment is a factor of 10. It's a 10^1, 10^2, 10^3. And the reason we do that is because if we used a geometric scale, you couldn't see any difference. You would see everybody except for stocks being a flat line on the bottom of the scale, and the others would just, the stocks would be going up, and you'd say, oh, look at stocks, everybody else is zero. Well, it's not zero, but because the stocks have a stronger return, exponential growth, we use a logarithmic scale. And my undergraduate degree is mathematics. I understand logarithms, but most people don't. They don't get the idea of what they're trying to show. They're trying to show that these numbers get large over time, and so we use a scale that allows us to show large numbers. I wish there was some better way to show it, but there isn't. Slide number 5. Here's an interesting graphic that shows rolling 10-year periods of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And again, we'll discuss that in the next presentation. We've been using these indices over and over again without really defining them, but we'll get to them. It's just a list of, in this case, 30 of some of the largest companies in the United States. And what we see is coming out of the Depression, 10-year periods that were negative. Yeah. So that doesn't happen too often, folks. Stocks go up and down, but as we said, they mostly have gone up over the last 80-some-odd years. But coming out of the Depression, World War II, we see some really 1950s and 60s go-go years and the modern society and chemicals and nuclear and everybody's going to own a car and suburbs, and then something along the line didn't work out so well. 1970s, yeah, where we just touched, just quite barely touched zero, the 10-year period. And what happened? Well, a lot of things. Vietnam War, culture clashes, civil rights, women's rights, gay rights, the gas crises of 73 and then 79, and Watergate. But the biggest problem with the 1970s was the baby boom generation. The baby boom generation coming of age, a huge bulge in the demographic profile, because it was your patriotic duty after World War II to go have as many kids as you could. And so now all these people need to get jobs and need to buy cars and refrigerators, and it was a very difficult time for the economy. They struggled with dealing with inflation and unemployment because of this, and it took its toll on the stock markets. And then look what happened. 1980s, new technologies, globalization, the Internet, blue skies, and productivity gains. Everybody's gonna be rich. Some of you were very young, but in the 1990s, new companies were coming out promising unbelievable returns, except a lot of them weren't making any money. And sure enough, 2000 came along and the stock market bubble first burst. And then we all transferred our affection to the housing market, and that bubble burst. And then you see negative 10-year returns for stocks. So that's why we call it the Great Recession. We don't want to use the term depression, but we have to go back to the Great Depression to see negative 10-year returns. Now, look at the last couple of years, folks. Does that mean we're going to have the same kind of rise in the stock, meteoric rise in the stock market over the next 20 some odd years? I don't think so. Doesn't mean it will. Doesn't mean it won't. That prediction is difficult, especially about the future. But I'm very optimistic. Personally, I'm very optimistic because of why? The developing markets. Much of the rest of the world has realized that, capitalism might be the worst possible economic system in the world, except for all the others, right? Hey, been there, done, didn't work out so well. How's that sugar cane doing, Mr. Castro? Oh, not so good. Anyway, so the rest of the developing world has realized that capitalism can bring prosperity. I don't know about happiness, but bring prosperity to its people, and they're copying us. As Neil Ferguson, a very famous economist, said, they've downloaded our apps and are now there. They want to mimic us and the developing world, in Latin America, Eastern Europe, the Far East, and now Africa is getting into the act. Africa has been booming lately, hard to believe. But we always consider them a basket case. No, they're doing well. But everything's relative, right? So I'm very optimistic, because what happens when these people, hundreds of millions of people, come out of poverty and begin to enter the middle class? Well, they want the same things that we take for granted. They want Pampers, and they want Tide, and they want McDonald's and Coca-Cola and Marlboro cigarettes. And so, we tend to concentrate on the companies in the developing market. But the reality is the biggest benefactor when an economy does well, at the outset, are the workers. The workers have more money in their pockets, and so they're able to buy the things that we take for granted. And so those companies that are supplying those things, don't you know that they've already figured this out, folks? You know, Coca-Cola makes 80% of its money outside the United States. You know, they're not exiting the United States, but they're definitely moving all around the world looking for new markets. And so that, for me, personally, bodes well. Is it a guarantee? No. Tomorrow, the whole thing could fall apart. Ebola could become all the rage, and the world is enveloped in a pandemic. A meteorite could hit. There could be another. The Kardashians, or whatever you say their names, could have another affair or something, and everything could fall down and all become nothing. But I don't think so. We'll see. Slide number 6. Traditionally, close to half of the return from stocks was from reinvested dividends. You see, stockholders used to expect 4 to 6% in dividends each year. That was as much or more than bonds returned in interest, since stocks were considered much riskier than bonds. So you're telling me, Piano, that stocks used to return 4, 5, 6%? Yes, that was typical. Not all did, but that was typical. And that was often as much or more than bonds, because bonds are guaranteed, right? You have to pay those interest payments when you issue a bond. I mean, they're guaranteed by the full faith and credit of the issuer, but they're still mandatory payments. You have to pay the interest. You have to pay the principal back. But dividends are not. And we see that the Standard & Poor's 500 dividend average, the 500 largest companies in the United States, from 1936 to 2008 was 3.8%. So that was the average. Some paid less, some paid more. But during the 80s and 90s, dividends fell to less than 2% or even 0%. Why? Because capital gains and growth were what investors wanted in the 1990s. Don't pay me any dividends. I want you to reinvest that money back in the company, grow the company, and I want you to grow the business and hence grow the value of the stock. And the Standard & Poor's dividend averaged from 1997 to 2007, 1.5%. You see, it dropped in half, right? Or even less than half. It dropped less than half. And there were various reasons that were given. Dividends were taxed at a higher rate than capital gains. People wanted the business to reinvest the earnings for growth instead of distributing it to the investors. Stocks were no longer considered riskier than bonds. There were some popular books that came out that said, oh, no, stocks aren't as risky as bonds. They lied. Of course they're riskier than bonds. Savings accounts were also paying less than 2% and now paying less than 1%. And, of course, people lost track of their senses and bid up the prices, which, you know, there's some of that, too. Slide number 7. We look at a graph that shows the yield on bonds, and specifically the 10-year Treasury bond, versus the yield on stocks. And where's the magic cursor? Here it is. We see that in 1960, they were fairly close, right? Stocks were paying almost 4%, and bonds were paying a little over 4%. And then they started to diverge. Stocks started going down, spiked in the 72-73 bear market. Meanwhile, bond yields started to skyrocket. Why? Because of the 1970s inflation. Everybody's trying to get a job. Everybody's trying to buy refrigerators and dishwashers and houses and cars. And then after Paul Volcker, who was the Federal Reserve Chairman under Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter appointed him. I know we used to have a president named Jimmy. I know it's hard to believe, some of you young folks, but we had a president named Jimmy, and he was up for re-election, and he said, Mr. Volcker, what can you do for me? Can you help break the back of inflation? And he said, yes, but it might cost you the election, Mr. President. And to his credit, Carter said, okay, we'll do it. And they ratcheted up. That wasn't the only thing that caused them the election. Iran hostage crisis was one of them too, and they did it. They ratcheted up short term interest rates, and long term interest rates followed, broke the back of inflation, and the 1980s was ensued with the era of optimism and new technologies, and we see the yields on bonds coming down. Inflation coming down, we see the yield on stocks coming down until the peak of 2000 when we were in some call it the internet bubble, or stocks, specifically technology stocks, but other stocks had risen to levels that had not seen, since the run up in the 1920s. Quite interesting. And the dividend on bonds, dividends yield on stocks went to 1%. And so the stock market took a crash. Bonds continued to do well. The yields on them came coming down until the turmoil of 2008. And then what happened? Well, because stocks went down so far, so fast, the dividend yield went up. Because even though many companies did cut their dividends, many kept paying their dividends. So the price went down. The yield, we'll learn how to calculate that in this chapter, went up. At the same time, people got so frightened that they stuffed all their money into bonds, specifically treasury bonds. And in 2008-09, we see that they crossed. The yield for stocks went above the yield for bonds. Now, this is normally a very good indicator. It's not a guarantee for stocks. And sure enough, stocks, since not 2009, have more than doubled from their low. But, of course, that was a huge panic and a huge turmoil. And at the same time, bonds they bounced back up but have fallen again. And as of December 31st, 2012, we see that the yield on stocks, about 2.2%, is greater than the yield on bonds, the 10-year Treasury bond, at 1.7%. Now, it's, February 2nd or something like that? And so what we see is in the last month, just 1 month, stock market has done pretty well. Bonds have gone from 10-year Treasury bonds, 1.7% to 2%. So they have responded. So now they're fairly close to one another again. What's going to happen in the future? Oh, I don't know. Prediction is difficult, especially about the future. But again, I tell you, I am optimistic. Come back in 5-10 years, and we'll see if I'm crying in my beer or smiling. Slide number 8. The pendulum swings. The bear markets of 2000 to 2002 and 2008 have changed investors' perceptions about dividends. We now see investors and companies focusing more and more attention on dividends. Many companies that never paid dividends in the past are doing so now. For example, many tech companies are no longer growth stocks. They are mature industries. They have cash coming out of their ears. They don't know what to do with. Last count, I think Apple had $130 billion in cash or cash equivalents. I mean, they could buy entire industries if they wanted to. They could buy the airline industry and the car, maybe not the car industry, but they could buy entire all the companies in an industry and still have cash left over. Also, the tax law has changed dividends so that they are taxed roughly the same as capital gains now. So that issue of, well, dividends are taxed higher than capital gains is not true anymore. It's not true anymore. And that's one of George W. Bush's, the younger Bush's legacies. He really pushed for that, and there was going to be temporary, and then they extended it in 2008 and 2010, and then they've made it permanent now in the 2012 fiscal cliff, whatever, I forget the name of the act. They finally came up. They finally got their act together at the end of 2012, and now, unless they change it, which someday they will, obviously, they capital gains and dividends are now taxed at the same rate permanently, which is a big, big coup for the stock investors. There's a wonderful name of a book. The book itself is it's not that great. It's written by a woman here who's based, I think she's retired now, but she was based in La Jolla for her career. Dividends Don't Lie. What a great line. Dividends Don't Lie. And the great thing about it is it's absolutely true. We're going to take a look at financial statements. Publicly traded corporations must, by law, that was part of the deal when they went public, they must report their financial statements every 3 months, quarterly. And they may be making the whole thing up. Most of them don't. You know, they do their best to give the right data. Some of them, like Enron, did their best to deceive the public. And so, can we believe those numbers? Usually yes, but maybe not. But can we believe the dividends that they report? Yes. Why? Because they cut us a check. They sent us the money. Now, they don't do checks anymore. They send it all electronically, but it is cash in our pocket. If they say they're paying 50 cents per share dividends, that we see that money go into our account. So dividends don't lie. And here's a quote from the famed industrialist, John D. Rockefeller. Now, I don't know if it's true or not. In fact, you go online and look it up. It was supposedly said by him to one of his neighbors. So take that for what it's worth. But it's a great line. Do you know the only thing that gives me pleasure? It's to see my dividends coming in. Okay. What are the pros and cons of stock ownership? Well, let's see. They allow the general public to share in the rewards of the business enterprises. They have been the best financial investment returns over time. I really should add that financial investment return. Some real estate investors might call me to task and say, oh yeah, well, real estate's beaten stocks. And my understanding is, on an absolute basis, no, stocks have done better, but it has to do with the way you actually invest in real estate. You use quite a bit of what we call leverage, and we'll discuss that over time and see how that magnifies your returns, but it also magnifies your losses. And they're very easy to buy and sell. Liquid investment, they're very liquid. Somebody wants your 100 shares of McDonald's. I can tell you that somebody will want to buy them. Yes. And now when you get into these penny stocks that are thinly traded, that the world doesn't apply, but they're not real companies to begin with. As we said, limited liability is one of the advantages. And one thing we don't, as investors often think about, we should, is this system has worked fairly well and has increased the standard of living for everyone. you know, as investors, we're trying to think about how we're going to make this money. You know, how are we going to? We're in it to make money, but at the same time, we are creating a standard of living for everybody. What are the cons? Well, they're risky, folks. Nothing comes free. Volatile. Isn't that a great word? Volatile. That's the industry's popular euphemism for I lost a lot of money. If you say to somebody, hey, how was that stock you bought? Oh, it was very volatile. What does it mean? Well, it usually means they bought it for $12 and sold it for 30 cents. Do you know anybody who's bought a stock for $12 and sold it for 30 cents? I know somebody who's done that. I've known him all my life. He's a regular guy. It was a great stock. I mean, it was based here in San Diego, and it was a high-tech and you're going to change the... Yeah. Anyway, and of course, the corporate and financial industry, hanky-panky, the shenanigans that some of these companies produce, and that's usually limited to the nether worlds of the OTC bulletin boards and pink sheets, and what are those we'll discuss soon enough. The vast majority of big-name companies don't get involved with this. Every once in a while, there's a huge scandal, and it paints everybody with a bad brush, but that's the exception in the big leagues, not the norm. It's the norm in the wrong side of the tracks, the bad side of town, the bulletin board and pink sheets, as we'll see, but you're going to stay away from them. I'm going to tell you lots of times to stay away from them. Now, we use the term volatility, but what does it mean? Well, let's take a look at the year 2012. Here's the Standard & Poor's 500 for the year 2012. And what we see is it started out on a pretty good note. You know, hey, things are looking up. Bum, bum, ba, bum, bum. And we go up from $10,000, and I don't know why the industry uses $10,000. That's what they use, so that's what I'll use. And it went up to $11,025. That's 11.25% in just a matter of months. Whoopee! Only to fall 11%, only to fall almost to hit 10,000. And then did a pretty, look at all the bumps along the way, but made its way up to almost 11,700 in September and October. Took a bit of a dip in November and then ended the year with a pretty darn good, a return at the end of the year. So you had 10,000 at the beginning of the year, you wound up with 11,000 and about 300. But, did you? You did if you left your money in. But what happens? People start off here and see the market go up, and then they get excited, and they put their money in here, and watch it tank, and they jump out thinking, I'll wait for it to get better, and they see it go up and up and up and up and up, and they go, okay, it's okay, it's good to get it back in, and then they watch it tank, and then they jump out. And what do most people do, folks? They buy high, sell low. What are we told to do? Buy low, sell high. And you see, as Warren Buffett likes to say, investing is simple, but it ain't easy. So if you're the kind of investor that's trying to time the market, trying to find out when the best time to invest is, all I can say is good luck. But if you're the kind of investor who's going to put $50, $100 a month away, or if you get the $10,000 inheritance and just stuff it in there and leave it, you should do well. But there are no guarantees and the world could fall apart. But if the world does fall apart, then it doesn't matter where you put your money now, does it? Now, let us spend some time discussing the primary and secondary markets. And what are these? This is where we buy and sell stocks. This is where we buy and sell securities. Not only stocks, but we're discussing stocks in this presentation. And there are two markets. There is the primary market. This is the market in which new issues of securities are sold to the public. It's also called initial public offering. When a company wants to enter the big leagues and become a publicly traded corporation, they go to investment bankers. And Chapter 5 goes into great detail about this process. I will not ask you any of the particulars about this. If you take the Series 7, you will need to know this extensively. But, as I say here, most retail investors, the little folk like you and me, do not participate in the primary market. And my recommendation is that we really don't belong there. This is for people who have lots of money to lose. Because initial public offering also stands for it's probably overpriced. And I've also heard it also stands for imaginary profits only. And for every one successful initial public offering, such as Google or MasterCard, there are many that fall by the wayside. So you're ready to take your company public. It's called going public or taking the company public. You create initial public offering, and now you're a publicly traded corporation. What happens next? Right, you are now traded on the secondary market. This is the market in which securities are traded after they have been initially issued to the public. And the vast majority of transactions all take place in the secondary market when you or somebody else are talking about the secondary market. You are talking about the stock market as we talk about it. We talk about the stock market, we're talking about the secondary market. Slide number 12. Why would a corporation go public? Well, why do corporations issue common stock? There are many reasons. To raise money, to start or expand a business, to help pay for ongoing business expenses. So we have a great idea. We're going to create this brand new drug that is going to utilize all these fabulous new biotechnology techniques that we've learned at UCSD in San Diego. Here in San Diego, there are many biotechnology firms. Why? Because there's lots of people who are learning about these technologies, and they need $500 million or more to take the drug to market because they've got to get it through the FDA process of determining whether it is effective and safe. So they do an initial public offering for $150 million. And then a few years later, they're running out of cash. They might do a secondary offering, meaning they are already an established company and they need to reissue some more stock to help pay for the ongoing business expenses. And once a company is large enough, it is just expected that to gain prestige and respect within the investment and industrial communities, they will go public. And Google is a great example of this, folks. Back in 2005, Google had been making money hand over fist throughout the early 2000s. And the investment community, the investment financial industry, cajoled Google to bring the company public. They were a little reticent. They weren't quite sure, the people who started Google, they weren't quite sure that they wanted to bring it public. Well, the financial industry was able to persuade them. Why? Because going public is also used as a reward for those who started the business. Yes, dear students, they become, if it's a successful initial public offering, and sometimes even if it's not that successful, they become instant multimillionaires, in some cases billionaires, on one day. So are you ready? Are you ready to work 18, 20 hours a day and give your life to a startup company that may go public and you'll become, yeah, well, for everyone, Google, right, there are dozens of Ask Jeeves, Lycos, Alta Vista. You don't know who these companies are. Dogpile. Right. It's not a guarantee. And also, simply because once a business becomes sufficiently large, it becomes very difficult for the owners to divvy up the spoils without going public. If you were one of the people who started GE or Coca-Cola or Walmart or Google, how would you sell your share of the business? You understand? Breaking it up into millions or billions of shares makes it easier to transfer ownership among individuals. Plus, once companies get sufficiently large and they're still private, transition of ownership and control of the corporation can be a real problem. And for those of you who are interested in business textbook cases, you want to look up the company known as In-N-Out Burger. And you might be a big fan of their food, because they, as my understanding, is that theirs is one of the few fast food chains that still use fresh meat in their stores. And the owners have since passed on, bequeathed the company to the younger generation, and there has been, my understanding, I don't know how it's all worked out, but within the family, there was a fight over how the company should continue. Should they continue with the same high standards for fast food? I mean, it's still fast food, but still continue with high standards, or should they relax their standards? It's a very, very interesting case study. So if you're interested, there are a few other large private companies you might look at. Have you ever heard of M&M's or Snickers? Mars, the candy company Mars, is one of the largest private companies around. Many mutual fund companies are private, some mutual fund companies. Big accounting firms and law firms, but they tend to be owned by the partners, by the people who run the company. And then there's a very large grocery store chain based, I think, in San Antonio, throughout the South and into the East Coast, called H-E-B. H-E-B, very large grocery store complex, that company. So if you're so inclined, do research on some of the largest private companies and how they grapple with those issues of transfer of ownership and control of the company. Continuing on slide 13, when you've gone public, when you've issued the shares, the corporation has no obligation to repay the money, to repurchase the shares of the stock. Once they are issued, the shareholder is now responsible for being able to find someone who will purchase the shares for them. You see? Unlike a bond, where if you borrow money, you must pay the interest, you don't have to pay dividends in a stock, and you must pay back the principal. Now, you don't have to pay back you don't have to repurchase the shares. But the corporation is now a public entity, and as such, it now has many rights and responsibilities that private companies just don't have to worry about. If you called up Mars and said, "How much money did you make last year?" they'll say, "Well, who are you? Are you the IRS?" You know, we don't have to tell you. But a publicly traded corporation, yes, they must tell you how much money they made. They must tell you how much assets, how much cash they have on hand, how much they've sold, their revenue, their earnings. And they must file these reports annually, 10-Ks, and quarterly, 10-Qs, with the Securities and Exchange Commission. And this data is available just a few clicks of a button, or go to your library. They must have at least one public meeting annually where shareholders can come and air their grievances. And a cute little story is SEMPRA, San Diego Gas and Electric, our local utility here, is based here in San Diego, one of the largest companies based here in San Diego. And they would have their annual meeting, and about 10, 12 years ago, they made a few boneheaded maneuvers, and it didn't work out so well for them. people went to their annual meeting and jumped up and down and screamed and hollered. And they said, all right, well, we'll fix your little red wagon. They held their annual meeting in London, which is, you know, not like you can drive there in a couple hours. And it, and it's very expensive, so they fixed those people. And as we said, Chapter 5 goes into much detail about initial public offerings. But the truth be told, initial public offerings do not usually live up to their expectations. Remember, it's probably overpriced. Imaginary profits only. The typical IPO loses 50% of its value in 1 year. So remember how well Google did. It came out of the... when it became public, within 6 months it had doubled in price. I mean, it was very, very successful public offering. But average public offering loses 50% of its value. And there's another internet company, I can't remember the name, Fleecebook, or is it Farcebook? I can't remember. Something to do with social diseases or something like that. And they went public last year, and they promptly lost 50% of their value. And even after losing 50% of their value, as we will see, they're still richly valued. Now, we'll take a look at this later on. We'll learn how to look at some of the metrics of stocks, and I want you to take a look at Google, and I want you to take a look at Fleecebook and see which one you think is more reasonably priced. Slide number 14. So now let's take a look at the aftermarket, the secondary markets. These are the markets in which securities are sold once they have been issued to the public. Secondary markets provide liquidity, which is an easy method for transferring ownership of securities, as opposed to if it's a large private company having a tough time. So that you have 100 shares of whatever, a large company, and not something, not a fly-by-night penny stock, as we'll see these issues. But no, a legitimate company. And you have 100 shares of McDonald's or whomever. There's somebody who wants to buy it from you, right? And they also provide an efficient mechanism for pricing and valuing those securities. So, for example, if you had 100 shares of Microsoft, and you were going to apply for a loan, and the company said, well, the lender said, do you have any assets? And you could say, well, sure, I got 100 shares of Microsoft. And they'd say, well, how much is it worth? You'd go to the market, you'd go to the stock market, the aftermarket, the secondary market, specifically the NASDAQ, call your broker or go online, and you would see that Microsoft is selling for whatever it's selling for, $25, $30, whatever it's selling for, and you'd say, look, I have 100 shares at $30 a share, and that would be a bona fide, meaning a realistic amount that the value is worth. But remember, it's changing every day, and they know that, the folks would know that. When people talk about the stock market, they are almost always referring to the secondary market. Unless they say this is initial public offering, they're talking about the secondary market. Now, on slide 15, we see a description of the two types of secondary markets. And let's read the bottom first. This is an outdated comparison. Due to technology advancements, mergers, and acquisitions, the traditional differences between the two different types of secondary markets have all but been erased, and the changes are just getting started. So what are we talking about here? The traditional places, let's use the cursor here, were the organized exchanges, securities and exchanges. And these were, and still are, even though they're really not, centralized institutions in which transactions are made in outstanding securities. And they used the double auction market, a face-to-face way of brokers to trade stocks and other securities, but we're discussing specifically stocks here. Well, along came the over-the-counter market. And some people really want this phrase, over-the-counter, to just disappear. They don't want to hear it anymore. Because this started as a widely scattered telecommunication network through which transactions are made in outstanding securities and smaller initial public offerings, and they use what is called a quote-based system. Well, when it started out, folks, when they say telecommunications, they mean telephone. Somebody in Minneapolis would get on the phone and call somebody in Atlanta and say, hey, I got it. Somebody wants to buy 100 shares of Amalgamated Consolidated. What are you selling them for? You know, this is a company that you've never heard of. It's some small company somewhere. And the guy in Alabama or Atlanta or wherever he was would say, I'm charging 25. The other guy said, it's too much money. They'd slam the phone down and call him back in 5 minutes and say, that's the way it was, right? But now with technology, it just isn't that way anymore. So let's continue and be more specific about the two and find that there's really no differences anymore, providing we're dealing with bona fide real companies. Slide number 16. The organized securities exchanges historically had all trading conducted on the floor, on the exchange floor. And these are the videos you see of people running around, jumping up and down, screaming and hollering at one another, making all kinds of hand expressions. The trading was conducted using what is called a double auction. So you are familiar with the one seller, multiple buyers auction, where you see an estate auction or a farm auction. So you see one person calling out prices and other people bidding on that, raising their hand or raising a card or whatever. But that's not the way it was done on the exchanges. On the floor of the exchanges, there were multiple sellers as well as multiple buyers. People calling out prices and quantities at all different times. And so it looked like chaos to those of us on the outside. Like, what are they doing? Well, they were facilitating trades, and there were multiple people selling and multiple people buying. But due to both technology and the sheer massive volume of shares traded, things have changed dramatically. Most of the trading now is conducted electronically. Yeah, there's some large trades that still involve significant human interaction, but they now consist of far less than 1% of the total number of trades. In fact, they still show, in some of the news shows, they still show the floor of the exchange, but it's very quiet. It is very few people running around, very little craziness going on. And so it's all done electronically. People are sitting in front of computer terminals, typing in orders and making buy and sell orders. Slide number 17. The granddaddy of them all is the New York Stock Exchange. The big board, the NYSE, some people call it, the NYSE. And it traditionally was responsible for over 90% of the volume of the transactions on the exchanges. And some 3,600 companies, traditionally the most prestigious, the largest companies, the New York Stock Exchange companies must meet stringent requirements. And before 2006, the New York Stock Exchange was a private organization, and only members who purchased seats on the exchange were allowed to make trades. But they were phased out. You know, they were phased out when the New York Stock Exchange went public in 2006. If a company falls on hard times, for example, Kodak, and they fail to meet the stringent requirements, they are delisted. Right? They are basically shown the door and said, sorry, we don't normally no longer want your presence on our exchange. So this was the big board, so to speak. Well, folks, It ain't what it used to be. Slide 18. Big changes at the New York Stock Exchange. Let's see. In 2005, they purchased the Archipelago Electronic Exchange. What is that? And what's the Pacific Regional Exchange? And then they became a publicly traded corporation in March of 2006. And no longer a private club of members' seats. No, they merged with the Euronext Electronic Exchange, phasing out face-to-face double auction trading in favor of exclusively trading electronically. And then in 2011, Germany's stock market, the Börse, based in Frankfurt, tried to purchase the New York Stock Exchange. But it was blocked by European regulators who said, no, you're going to get too big. That's the whole idea, guys. And so the German Börse basically said, all right. I don't think the United States regulators were going to stop it. And then we hear just recently that the New York Stock Exchange is now being acquired for $8 billion by a 12-year-old derivative trading firm from Atlanta. Oh, give me a break. You see, the old-timers who have since passed on, if they were to be reanimated, if they were to come back to life and take a look at what's happened, they would not believe it. They could not believe that there would be a day when the New York Stock Exchange was bought by some upstart from Atlanta. Well, what will it mean for investors and for trading, Well, it is difficult to know if the average investor will be able to notice any big differences soon. You still do what you do, either through a broker or through your internet brokerage account. But the oft-mentioned, oft-discussed ultimate goal is to have 24-hour non-stop electronic trading. Wait a minute. It's 2 a.m. in the morning, and you just have to sell your 200 shares of Procter & Gamble, so you jump out of bed. What do you think of this possibility, huh? I don't know that if it sits well with me, but hey, that's why there's chocolate and vanilla, and some people like strawberry. Maybe there's people who can't wait until 6:30 in the morning here on California time. Slide number 19, the floor brokers. Well, are they on the floor anymore? House brokers would execute orders on behalf of their firm's customers or occasionally on behalf of the firm's own account. And then the $2 brokers, as they were called, the independent brokers, would provide as-needed execution services to house brokers, member or non-member broker dealers. Well, they're not there anymore on the floor of the exchange. The floor brokers are very worried that the New York Stock Exchange's aggressive moves to all electronic trading means the end of their way of life as they know it. Well, it's not the end, folks. It's a big change, yes, from face-to-face interaction to sitting in front of a computer screen all day. Now, does this sound familiar? What are we doing right now? Here I am, giving a presentation as if there were a classroom in front of me, but I'm sitting in my room here talking to my computer, and I'm this little microphone in front of me, and you are listening to this at a different time in a different place at your leisure, either on your MP3 player, or maybe you downloaded it to a CD, or maybe you're watching it on your screen. You see, technology is changing the world at a breakneck speed. And we can either embrace it, or we can, I don't know, not much we can do. I don't necessarily like it, folks. I really would rather teach face-to-face. I love having the students and the interaction. But hey, it's not about me. I'm getting paid to teach you. It's not the other way around. And so that's why I'm doing my best to adapt. And I some people have given me a... have said, yeah, it's working out okay, and some people have said, we put these on iTunes, mostly because iPhones and iPod Touches and iPads don't do Flash Files, and Flash Files, folks, are really nice. I mean, they're small, and they still look pretty good, but Apple mobile devices will not support them, and I didn't think anybody but in the class would ever use it, but people all over watch it and listen to it, and I get some praise. I get some good comments, and then I get these people who say, this guy is annoying. This is horrible. And I think, hey, it's free. What are you complaining about? Let's go on to somebody else. Slide number 20. Anyway, The Specialist. How did I go off on that tangent? I apologize. The New York Stock Exchange for decades have had The Specialist. And now it's a subtle thing. Let's read together. The stock exchange members who specialized in making transactions in one or more stocks. The job of the specialist was to manage the auction process. The specialist would buy or sell the stock from their own inventory to provide a continuous, fair, and orderly market. Now, you noticed I was using the past tense. Because what's going on with the specialist? Well, the role of the specialist is being squeezed out by technology and the tremendous volume of trading. They are becoming less and less involved in the typical market trading day. And this is what their job was, folks. They were to watch over the trading. Now, if you're on the floor, it's pretty easy to watch, right? You can see people doing it there. And if, for example, all the buyers disappeared and the price plunged, their job was to step in and buy. And if all of a sudden all the sellers disappeared and everybody wanted to buy and the price spiked, their job was to get in there and sell. And from time to time, the specialists were either praised or maligned. Suffice to say that the specialists were trying to make a profit just like everybody else, while their goal may seem altruistic. In other words, they're being very selfless. No. They make sure that when the market receives benefits from their efforts, so do they. But as we said, they're disappearing. They're not needed with the new technology. And some might say, this is not a good thing. Right? The flash crash, as it was called, shows that we need these people. Most of them say that they're specialists. But others are saying, no. We'll figure out how to keep those blips from happening again. I don't think so. Not anytime soon. Technology is going faster than we can control it. Slide number 21. Now, the kid on the block for decades was the American Stock Exchange. And, folks, it was right down the block. They were called the Amex. We're in the past tense again. Yeah, wait, hang on a minute. They were called the Curb. The Curb, what a silly name. Well, they started out on the curb of the New York Stock Exchange. You can see pictures of guys, and they all dressed alike, standing out on the curb, and they were buying and selling. They'd look inside the window, see what's going on, and eventually they gave them their own building down the street. It gets pretty cold in the wintertime in New York. And they always were much, much smaller than the New York Stock Exchange. So they saw the writing on the wall, and in the early 90s, they started concentrating on securities other than stocks. Remember the ETFs that we discussed in Mutual Fund Chapter 4? They were first introduced on the American Exchange. In 1998, they were purchased by the NASDAQ. The NASDAQ, as we'll see, they've become the two horse. They become the other horse in the two horse race with the New York Stock Exchange. So the NASDAQ thought, well, it's time for us to buy the Amex, and then they kicked them out the door in 2004. And then the New York Stock Exchange bought the Amex in 2008 and moved them down the street to the same building, and changed their name to the New York Stock Exchange MKT. Now, I don't even know anybody who knows how it's pronounced. Market? New York Stock Exchange MKT? Market? And you would think that they would have told, they would somehow have some kind of communique to the brokers, some kind of communication to the brokers, because this in the past would have been a big deal, but now with the changes happening so fast, nobody even noticed. Nobody cared. I asked my boss when I figured it out. I just figured out I was doing a little bit of surfing about the internet, just reading and checking things out. And I thought, NYSE market, what is this? What is the Amex? And I called my boss and I said, did you know they changed the name? He goes, no. Did anybody tell you? He goes, no. this is what's happening. It's changing so fast. They don't even bother to communicate to the brokers. So bye-bye, American Exchange. It's now called the New York Stock Exchange, MKT, or market. And then the regional stock exchanges. The regional stock exchanges were modeled after the New York Stock Exchange and the Amex. But again, they never became anything more than 4% of the total volume. Chicago, Philadelphia, Pacific, Boston, Denver, CA, Cincinnati. And they were all individual centralized locations, except for the Pacific, which was in Los Angeles and New York and San Francisco at the same time. Figure that one out. But many of the securities listed on the regional exchanges are just also available in New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ. And traditionally, the regional exchanges were often places where undesirable or unethical issues were sold. The Denver Exchange was famous for this. If somebody came up to you and said, "Hey, I just bought this great new company somebody told me about. It's on the Denver Exchange," you would just shake your head and say, "Oh, good luck." Lately, they've tried to diversify and differentiate themselves from the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ just to survive. Plus, they have not been immune to the rush to consolidate. The New York Stock Exchange bought the Pacific Exchange, and the NASDAQ bought the Philadelphia Exchange. You see what's happening here? You know, bigger and bigger and bigger. Now, where are these things, these derivatives sold, the options and futures exchanges? Well, they traditionally were sold on the Chicago Board Options Exchange for options and the Chicago Board of Trade for futures. We will discuss those in detail later. But now, options and futures are also traded on most all the major and regional exchanges, as well as the Chicago Board of Options Exchange and the Chicago Board of Trade. So these are just places where they started, but now they're everywhere. And lastly, the OTC market. So all the other places where the exchanges were centralized locations, except for the Pacific, which was two centralized locations, figure that one out. But now we're going to leave the realm of the exchanges and go into the over-the-counter market. And as we said, these started out as widely scattered telecommunications networks through which transactions of securities were made. There was no single location. It's also called the OTC. There's no one place where this happens. It happened all over the place. And it was based, or it is still based, on a quote-based system, as opposed to the double auction where people are screaming and hollering in one location. People would list their prices, and they would bid and ask, as we'll see on the upcoming slides, what they will buy it for and what they will sell it for. And there are three tiers. The top tier is called the NASDAQ. Now, the NASDAQ will take great umbrage. You like that word, umbrage? It means offense. They won't like it. If you call them OTC, they don't want to even hear that word. Why? Because of the second two tiers, the bulletin board and the pink sheets. The bulletin board and the pink sheets are the netherworlds. They're the wrong side of the tracks, folks. The bad side of town. The red light district. Stay away from these places. There are thousands of companies listed, and most all of them, not all of them, but almost all of them, are not real companies. There's somebody's garage in Idaho or Iowa or one of those places that starts with the letter I. And they're not real companies. So just stay away. If anybody tries to get you to buy any penny stocks on the OTC bulletin board or the OTC pink sheets, just say no thanks. Because there are some companies, yes, that have fallen on hard times and are trying to make it, trying to do business with honor and with integrity. But they're the exception, not the norm. So let us now discuss the role of dealers. As we saw in the exchanges, there were brokers and specialists. But the OTC started with what are called dealers, also called market makers. And dealers are traders who make markets by offering to buy and sell certain securities at stated prices. So remember the specialists would keep an inventory of the stock and manage the process? But mostly their job was to stay out of it and watch it. No, not with the dealers, the market makers. They offer buy and sell quotes from their own inventory of stocks, whereas brokers simply serve as a go-between between buyers and sellers. Brokers traditionally, but that's changed now, but brokers kept no inventory. They were just acting as a go-between. Now, you have to memorize these names, and I know they're not really good names. I would have called them retail and wholesale, but it wasn't up to me. The ask price is the price a dealer offers to sell the security to you. In this case, we're discussing stocks, but it doesn't have to be stocks, but we're talking about stocks. The bid price is the wholesale price. That's how much they will buy it from you. And how do you remember? Well, I don't know if this helps, but you remember the old saying, if you have to ask, it's too expensive, right? So the ask price is always going to be more expensive because that's how much they will sell it to you. But if you go to sell it back to them, they will only give you the bid price. And how do they make their money? They don't charge a commission. They make their money on the spread, the difference between the bid and ask prices. Now, on the NASDAQ, reputable OTC market, the spread is going to be minuscule for most all reputable companies. But for these penny companies, the spreads are going to be enormous. And that's why we want you to stay away from them. So let's continue. But you have to remember that. The difference between the bid and the ask prices is the spread. The ask price is the retail price, the higher price. The bid price is the lower price. That's the price that they will buy it back from you. So unlike slide number 26, unlike brokers who charge a commission, dealers make money from the spread of the bid and ask prices. Now, what is this similar to? Well, many of you are familiar with the casas de cambio in San Isidro and Otay and Tijuana. Just as the casas de cambio along the border make money on the difference between the prices in which they buy and sell pesos and dollars, the dealers and the market makers, they mean the same thing, dealers, market makers, they make money off of the difference between what they will sell you the security, the stock, and what they will buy it back from you. And the dealers' markups or markdowns are not reported to the customers. Whereas the broker's commissions are always reported, they don't show you how much of a difference you paid between the bid and the ask price. So how do you think the internet brokers make money on only $5 or $7 per trade? Hang on a minute, more later. All right, now the NASDAQ. We've been talking about the NASDAQ, and what is it, and where did it come from? Well, NASDAQ stood for National Association of Securities Dealers Automated Quotation System. Now, do you have to remember that? No, because they don't even want you to remember that. They now refer to themselves as simply the NASDAQ. They don't refer to themselves as the old organization, the National Association of Securities Dealers. They don't refer to themselves as the National Association of Securities Dealers Automated Quotation System. They just refer to themselves as the NASDAQ. And who was the National Association of Securities Dealers, the NASD? Well, that was the non-governmental organization that used to be responsible for self-regulation of registered representatives. That's the legal term for stockbroker. Brokerage firms and the like were regulated by the NASD on the behalf of the Securities and Exchange Commission. So this was not a governmental organization, but it was sponsored by the governmental organization known as the Securities and Exchange Commission. Well, they started the National Association of Securities Dealers Automated Quotation System, the NASDAQ, back in 1971. And it's supposed to be all uppercase, which I have a problem with, but that's the way it's written. That's the way it's supposed to be written. Well, when it first started, it was a tiny little thing where small companies started there, but they got big. And many of these companies were technology companies. And it used to be that once a company got large enough, the company would move to the New York Stock Exchange. That was just expected. Well, in the 1980s and the 1990s, many prestigious companies, some of the world's largest companies now, decided to stay on the NASDAQ rather than move to the New York Stock Exchange. And who are some of these companies? Microsoft, Intel, Dell, Qualcomm, Starbucks, Costco, Google, Facebook. And you can just imagine the two words that the folks at the New York Stock Exchange said. The first one was, oh, right. Oh, no! Now it's a two-horse race, where for decades the New York Stock Exchange was the place to be. It ain't true anymore. Not now, but for a while there, Apple was the world's largest company, and it's based on the NASDAQ. I think it now has fallen back below ExxonMobil. But still, these companies are very, very large, and they would certainly be welcome on the New York Stock Exchange. But they said, no, thank you. We're very happy on the NASDAQ, and now it's a two-horse race. And the job of the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ, it seems to be, is to each get as big as possible, making themselves bigger and bigger and bigger. And, yeah. Slide number 28. The NASDAQ is now a three-tier system. There's the global select market. Yeah, you know what? You don't really have to know this stuff, folks. Only people who are aficionados of the markets would really want to know about the differences between the three. The global select market is about 1,500 creme de la creme, and these companies would easily qualify for the New York Stock Exchange. There's the global market, which used to be called the national market, which are about 700 larger companies. And then there's the capital market, which used to be called the small cap market, which are about 500 smaller companies. And in the 1990s, the NASDAQ began positioning itself as the securities market of the future. Isn't that cute? Meaning the New York Stock Exchange is the securities market of the past. As it became apparent that the traditional face-to-face double auction model was not adequate to keep up with the massive increase of trading. So they were taking a jab at the New York Stock Exchange. I mean, you gotta remember, the New York Stock Exchange wasn't sitting still. They realized that the double auction model, the face-to-face, was not going to cut it into the future. They were making moves to do everything electronic also, but the NASDAQ was basically taking jabs at them, and I don't know. That's think of it as you will. Slide number 29. Now, technology offered other alternatives, and they are called alternative trading systems. The third market. The over-the-counter transactions made in securities listed on the New York Stock Exchange, the Amex, or one of the other organized exchanges. But these were meant just for institutional investors who traded in large blocks of securities. So you're a mutual fund company, or you're an insurance company, or a pension plan, and you have 100,000 shares, not 100 shares. Well, you could go to the New York Stock Exchange, or the Amex, or the NASDAQ, but by going through the third market, you could reduce your transaction costs because these dealers on the third market would hook you up with another mutual fund company or another insurance company or somebody else who was making a huge block of purchase orders. So you were going to sell 100,000 shares, they were going to buy 100,000 shares, and you understand that, you know, let's get off the markets where they're buying 200-300 shares at a time. And this was one of the examples of this was the Intermarket, which is now owned by NASDAQ. Interesting. NASDAQ Intermarket. And then the fourth market was the same idea, but these electronic communications networks, as they came to be known, attempted to bypass the dealers. These fourth markets were transactions made directly between large institutional buyers and sellers of securities. So you did not even have to go through a dealer. They were privately owned electronic trading networks that automatically matched buy and sell orders that customers placed electronically. So you see, think of it like eBay, but instead of buying and selling whatever, you know, Tchotchkes or Beanie Babies or whatever people buy and sell on eBay, you're buying and selling stocks. Well, one of them was called Archipelago, and notice that New York Stock Exchange bought Archipelago, and another one is called BATS. What a great name, right? Better Alternative Trading System. And folks, I want to tell you that BATS now has about 10 to 20% of the market share of all the trading going on, and they are based in a strip mall in Kansas City. Think about it. Think about what the technology has done. Everything used to go through New York. I mean, not everything, but everything of very import. You know, they had the regional exchanges. But now you got some people in what used to be a shopping mall, but it used to be grocery stores and the like, and now they've, it's a whole lot cheaper to do business in Kansas City than it is in New York, and they are successfully courting retail customers. Well, what do you think? The NASDAQ, the New York Stock Exchange, they see the Rand writing on the wall. They're trying to do the same things. So the NASDAQ bought the Intermarket, and the New York Stock Exchange bought the Archipelago, fourth trading system. Ugh, unbelievable. The changes are just getting started. Slide number 31. But let's take a moment and ask ourselves, and this is what a lot of people still believe, isn't the stock market all just one big malignant casino? Well, the problem with the answer is that it is both yes and it is no. When people jump up and down and scream and holler and say, those crooks on Wall Street, it's one big crapshoot at malignant casino, you have to acknowledge that for some, the answer is yes. There are many individuals who see the markets as one big crapshoot, one roll of the dice. For them, the way to riches is to buy and sell, buy and sell, buy and sell. But remember, we don't call these people investors. We call them speculators or traders. TRADERS. It is very difficult to do, as we saw in Chapter 1, and you are up against the best in the business. And neophytes become very upset when the market turns against them, because it invariably will. But the answer is also no. The stock market is not just one big malignant casino. It is a way for you to participate in the global growth of the economy and do well, providing we do well. Many others look at the markets as a way to participate in the growth and prosperity of the global economy. With a long-term orientation, they are usually very well rewarded. We call them investors. And I want you to take a look at this quote from Benjamin Graham, Warren Buffett's teacher and the person who wrote The Intelligent Investor. An investment operation is one which, upon thorough analysis, promises safety of principal and an adequate return. Operations not meeting these requirements are speculative. Now, Mr. Graham said some harsh words about stocks. He, for the most part, thought most people should just stay away from them, because is there safety of principal in stocks? No. Does it promise an adequate return? Well, not really. So he would consider almost all stocks as speculative. I tend to disagree with him, and so does his mentor, his famous famous student, Warren Buffett. But you have to understand that, yes, folks, you will come across people who look at it as and treat it like a casino. And you have to, I don't know what you have to do, but you have to understand that that's their choice. But my students are not going to do that, right? Good. Okay, let's continue. Oh yeah, Pliano, what about Enron, huh? Aren't corporations all crooks? Well, the truth is that fraud and accounting trickery and gimmicks have always been with us. They are always going to be with us. They asked the famous bank robber, Willie Sutton, after he had been caught, why do you rob banks? And he said, because that's where the money is. Yeah. Normally, but not always, those firms that engage in fraud and accounting trickery, they are regulated to the nether reaches of the OTC, the bulletin board, the pink sheets. But, you know, there they come along. Enron and WorldCom. But for every one Enron, there are hundreds, no, thousands of companies that continue to do business with integrity and honesty. Well, usually. Look, 40 years ago, it's nothing new, folks. 40 years ago was Equity Funding. This was an insurance company that went out of business. Now, how many insurance companies have you ever heard to go out of business? That doesn't happen. Well, it does happen when you do this. What did they do? They would go into a room and literally make up insurance policies. They make up people as signed up for insurance policies and paying in every month the monthly premiums or the yearly premiums. Well, that didn't last too long. That's a scam. 25 years ago, it was Ivan Boesky and Vagabond Inns. Vagabond Inns, they're based here in San Diego. You've probably seen them. There's one on Broadway, Chula Vista, there's one in Point Loma. Well, Mr. Boesky was using Vagabond Inns as a front for insider trading. Vagabond Inns was just an innocent victim. 4 years ago, 5 years ago, it was Fannie, Freddie, Lehman Brothers, Citi, WaMu, and AIG. And don't forget Bernie! Bernie Madoff! How did he do it? How did he keep a Ponzi scheme going for 15 years? Unbelievable. And 20 years from now, during the next big bull market craze, somebody else will take their place. They're always going to be with us. That's why we need to be on our guard. But they're the exception once you get into the big companies, not the norm. So, slide number 33. To recap, the securities markets exist to allow investors a safe, if cost-effective method to participate in the success of the global economy, and even with all the underhanded shenanigans, they have performed very well. They are changing at breakneck speed, and the change is accelerating. Whether or not we ever have one or more global 24-hour trading markets remains to be seen, but it is exciting, and for some scary, to watch. Especially for those of us who have a stake in the outcome. So, what do you think? You excited? I hope so. I am. I want you to go back over and make sure you understand the exchanges and the markets and the introduction to stocks. When we come back, we will discuss in detail the items that we've been discussing since the beginning of the semester, the indices, the Standard & Poor's 500, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the NASDAQ. And we'll talk a little bit about transactions. Okay, see you next time. Study hard. Bring honor and glory to Southwestern Community College.